This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 17th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 162nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're beginning with literature and slowly graduating down to art like a cultural paint chart. Here's what's on our palette. We'll be delving into the fascinating and unlikely world of Arabic science fiction.
I think there is a kind of resurgence of the idea of using science fiction or even elements of horror that touch on science fiction to look again at the world we are in and discover something new.
We'll go for a whirl around Istanbul's art fair, and we'll look at fictional representations of Lagos via a new art show right here in London.
I think my memories of Lagos are extremely subjective and extremely romantic and rose-tinted, and in a way, what's interesting about the kaleidoscope is that it compounds that.
Plus, we'll crack the spine of the Singapore Art Book Fair and get bluesy and dusty with a live Midori House session from Mali's Songhoi Blues. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We'll kick things off with a bit of African desert blues punk. Songhoi Blues are live in session. The band hail from Timbuktu but fled to Bamako after Islamist militants took over the north of Mali and forbade the playing of music. It was a harrowing journey which involved leaving loved ones behind in order to start a new life in the capital. But after a year in Bamako, Songhoi Blues were spotted by Africa Express, who invited them to record a track for their album Maison des Jeunes. Since then, the band has worked with Blur frontman Damon Alban and Nick Zinner of the Yeahs on a new record called Music in Exile, which is due out next February. They've also made a film named They Will Have to Kill Us First, due to premiere at next year's South by Southwest. We squeezed the quartet into the Midori House studios for quite a wonderful session. Let's begin at the start. Here's the track that launched them into the ears of listeners worldwide on that Africa Express album. It's called Subur.
Tazi, matazi gai zubur. Taije na tazi, matazi gai zubur. Adawula no tazi, matazi gai zubur. Pakau tereidi, matazi gai zubur. Perei na jerei, matazi gai zubur. Subu na munye, ocha nurnyadi. Subu na munye, ocha nurnyadi. Matazi gai zubur, taije no tazi. Matazi gai zubur, taido na tazi. Matazi gai zubur, bakau tereidi. Matazi gai zubur, perei na jerei. Matazi gai zubur, subu na munye, ocha nurnyadi. Subu na munye, ocha nurnyadi. subur, 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 yar main subur, subur, yar main subur. Alman koi nei main subur, subur, subur. Alman koi nei main subur, subur, yar main subur. War kam koi chau main subur, subur, yar main subur. Alwa ki nei main subur, subur, yar main subur. War kam zogu main subur, subur, yar main subur. War kam foto main subur. Subur yar main subur, subur yar main subur. Subur namunye, oja nunyadi. Subur namunye, oja nunyadi. Hey, subur namunye, oja nunyadi.
That was Songhai Blues with Subur. More Malian magic later. Second of all, then, we're heading at light speed. We're twisting through the firmament into the unlikely world of Arabic science fiction. Why unlikely? Because perhaps we think that sci-fi literature is the preserve of the Brits, French, Americans. But science fiction's wellspring is the strangeness that's either on the surface of a society, the violence and madness of much of the current Middle East, or the forces lurking just beneath that surface. Those weird social undercurrents, the iron grip of governments, the strangeness of family, tradition, all the rest. Hassan Abdul Razak is an Iraqi-born scientist and writer and spoke me through the plot lines of a fascinating genre ahead of a talk last week at London's Science Museum.
Some people consider there are certain stories within the Arabian Nights, which is probably one of the most famous kind of bodies of literature, that have elements of science fiction. I mean, even something as everybody knows, the flying carpet, is an intriguing
kind of concept. It's eminently stealable for Star Wars films.
Absolutely, yeah. And there were other stories in the past about imagined aliens arriving and interrogating human beings and so on. I suppose straightforward science fiction, as we think of it, the ones you mentioned with aliens, is also linked with technological advancements. And it's no secret that the Arabs were once leaders of that but have fallen behind in recent times. So maybe that kind of science fiction is not necessarily there. But I think there is a kind of resurgence of the idea of using science fiction or even elements of horror that touch on science fiction to look again at the world we are in and discover something new. So there is an award-winning novel that came out, I think, about a year ago called Frankenstein in Baghdad. It won the Arabic Booker equivalent.
Everyone wants to pick a title off the shelf with that name.
Yeah, it's a very good title. It intrigued a lot of people. I think there were even movie producers are interested. It's a fantastic idea of taking Mary Shelley's very famous Frankenstein, not a novel that is immediately obvious to transpose into Iraq, but Ahmed Saadawi, this very gifted writer, took the idea that somebody creates a monster out of the body parts of car bombing victims in Baghdad, and what that means for the society and what that means for the people who were responsible for creating this havoc in the first place.
So, and I suppose this is also riffing off the fact that science fiction comes from this place. It comes from societies in flux, and I guess it's always trying to tap into some sort of pathology beneath the surface. There is the murderous beneath the surface, if not on the very surface, as unfortunately obviously has been in Iraq.
I mean, Iraq is just such a crazy dystopian place.
Yeah.
That is, it's very kind of ripe for literary exploration and using that way. I've recently been asked to contribute a science fiction short story. Well, it was a short story. The remit was to imagine Baghdad in 100 years. And I just wanted to go completely crazy. So my story starts with this couple called Oor and Una. They're living in Sector 2047, Central Point. They've just moved there. They're having marital problems, sexual problems. And we just think this is a couple's in the future. They get invited to this place, the sampling feast. They get there by all this kind of high-tech way, and they arrive. And it's like this big fair where they're offered wine and so on. But there's this one wine merchant who's making wine according to the old ways. And they taste it, and they're intrigued by the taste. They've never tasted anything like it. And they ask what it's made out of. And he tells them it's made out of grapes. And then they ask if he makes any regular wine. And then he takes out blood out of a 37 incubator, and it's the blood of locals. It's got the logo of two rivers, you know, the two rivers in Baghdad.
Yeah.
and suddenly we realize we're in a different world. These are aliens that have invaded. Of course, the big joke is that once again, Baghdad was the point of invasion. Why did they pick Baghdad again? Everybody's speculating on was it the location? Was it the climate? What was it? Everybody's expecting, you know, New York to have been the place which the aliens mispronounce as Newipork. That kind of way is a lovely way to re-examine this whole history of the Iraq War, for example, as well as to meditate on our place and how we treat animals and, you know, the cruelty we can have without realizing it because everything is so mechanized nowadays. And you can do it with humor and you can do it with science fiction and it's intriguing. Whereas if you try to write something very straightforward, I think, where, you know, that wears the heart on the sleeve very clearly, then that can be very off-putting.
I guess that's the problem. It becomes a novel of ideas, becomes a novel of issues, and that's, I guess, less digestible than something that can be an allegory or can be a metaphor for something, and can use the sort of tricks of the trade of a genre novel, presumably also to bypass censorship. I mean, reading around the subject of Arab science fiction, this is something perhaps the whole of the region, the Middle East, rather than just Arabic specifically, is obviously something where there are troubles that need to be voiced, maybe, or that feel that they need to be voiced. And raising your problems in terms of a genre, using the tricks of a genre, presumably are a way of getting the message out when otherwise it might be censored.
That is absolutely the case. I can give you a very clear example of this, where I went to visit Syrian refugee camps in northern Iraq, and I collected some amazing stories, but I didn't know kind of how to write it. And then recently I was approached by this organization, that will remain nameless for this interview, who have asked me to write this play, but it's going to be produced in an Arabic country. And there were certain red lines I can't cross. Normally, a writer would just go, oh, this is so annoying, I want to write about this directly. But that was inspirational for me because it made me think of how to abstract that story further and then create something that is actually much more universal. And I can say, possibly, I hope, really subversive things, but they won't, you know, they won't necessarily come like that. And actually, when you think in that way, you can possibly produce something that will have a longer lasting thing than if you, let's say, address the specific issue of Syrian refugees coming in, because then you start to abstract it further and further. So my play is going to be set in the future, and the catastrophe that's happened is not a war where we get into the murkiness of politics. It's a kind of environmental catastrophe. But you can touch on a lot of subjects that way as well if you abstract it in the right way.
And it's one of those things, I presume, that Arabic science fiction is a great sort of font of potential, because as we say, the unfortunate political circumstances and social circumstances and actual circumstances, it is something that, to use that awful phrase, you almost couldn't make it up, unfortunately. Is it easy to share fiction? Is it easy for it to be read in Iraq, for example, and in the places in which it's set? Or is it enjoyed by Arabs in London and in Europe, in North America, perhaps, more than it is on the ground?
Well, I think a novel like Frankenstein in Baghdad has done both.
Yeah.
I think it's appealed to both. There are general problems in the publishing world and the Arab world, which it's not related necessarily to science fiction, in terms of securing your rights, making sure you really get the royalties, knowing how many, you know, whether your publisher really sold as many copies as they told, or they sold more and kept all of those kind of elements that have to do with corruption, that have to do with the larger set of corruption. And there is piracy, that is piracy galore, you know. So a lot of books are available on the internet and PDF, and obviously the writers are not going to get the money out of that. So these are the kind of issues. But, you know, a novel like Frankenstein in Baghdad, yes, it won the Booker and that lifted it, but because both within Iraq, and it's a novel that's now been widely read there, but also outside, and hopefully when it gets translated to English, it will have a greater readership as well.
I guess even within genres, there are fashions within genres. And I wonder if there are any hallmarks to the kinds of books that have been written, Arabic science fiction that have been written in the last sort of 5 years, and where you see the genre going, whether it becomes very, whether it does take off into the stratosphere literally, and it becomes like your play, like your short story about aliens, but in a kind of interesting social way rather than the kind of zapping them way. Or if you see it becoming an ever more subtle critique of the regimes that rule, the certain governments that rule the Middle East at the moment.
I would like personally to see, you know, the politics will always be there, and they've been tackled in fiction often through, I mean, yes, you can tackle it by science fiction, but there are, you know, successful popular writers who've done it through comedy, for example. That's a very powerful way to kind of bring down a government, a peg or two. But I would like to see a kind of meditation on where we're going in the region, and where we could go, and not necessarily only focusing on the negative. I mean, also on the kind of weird aspects. Anybody who's spent any time in Dubai, for example, it is a weird city. It is such
I always thought that if Ballard had lived to write another novel, he should have set it there.
Ballard would go crazy.
He would go crazy.
I was invited by the New York University campus. And when I left, I was by the New York University in Abu Dhabi. And when I left, I was like, your campus just looks like something out of a Ballard novel. And I would love to stick around, because in a Ballard novel, when they first arrive, it looks like a utopian, this fantastic community. But then later, you know, people are taking weird drugs and having strange sex, and then they start to kill each other for no particular reason. And it's a shame that I was there for just a short time. I didn't get to find out whether that was the case. And I told them that, they were like all kind of staring at me like... And they laughed, kind of a knowing laugh, which made me think I was probably guessing the right thing. So I would love to spend more time in that country. It's got amazing architecture. It's got these amazing enclaves of areas, like the New York University is like a little bit of America that's in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
And it's going to create some. It's a new place as well. Let's not forget that. So you know, the fiction will come, I'm sure.
That was Hassan Abdul Razak talking us through Arabic sci-fi. Up next, books in Brazil. For over 10 years, Brazil has hosted its international literary festival, FLIP, which attracts listeners and readers from all over the world. And as Brazilians are increasingly enjoying books, 3 years ago, another literary festival was created. This time, it's called FLUP, named after the unified police units that are set up in Rio de Janeiro favelas. Specifically targeted to a younger, lower middle class segment of the population, FLUP is looking to get more young Brazilians into reading and writing. And with poetry slam competitions and workshops, it seems to be working. Monocle's Rio correspondent Sheena Rossiter visited FLUP to meet Brazil's next generation of authors.
Off the train and across the overpass, as famed football stadium Maracanã becomes more faint in the background, I inch closer to the base of Rio de Janeiro's Favela Mangueira. Through the Samba School and past the statue of Cartola, a famous sambista from Mangueira, this favela is known for producing some of the world's best samba. But as I go into the Technical Art School, only a stone's throw away from the Cartola statue, I see a whole other layer of culture this part of Rio has to offer at the FLUP Literary Festival.
Na puta!
Cara, a gente revelou uma nova geração de escritores.
That's Julio Ludimir, one of the creators of FLUP. When he first started FLUP 3 years ago, the response he got from most people was, "You must be crazy." To many, the idea of hosting a literary festival in a favela seemed like a non-starter, in an area where illiteracy and low education levels are prevalent. But 3 years on, the festival is proving to be a success, as it encourages more people from Brazil's slums to read and write.
Existe. Tem um mundo que está mudando. Eu sou de uma geração...
FLUPS acts as a platform to showcase Brazilian talent that comes from underprivileged backgrounds, he tells me. A platform like this is something that was never offered before in Brazil.
Negro no Brasil.
He says that this talent has always existed here, but that no one was around to see it happening. But now, with FLUP running for a whole week every year, he says people are starting to notice this new budding talent from the fringes of Brazilian society.
Sem ele ou sem uma pessoa como ele. Coincidiu de ser ele.
A perfect example of FLUP giving a head start to unrecognized Brazilian authors is Binho. This year, he's a recipient of the Carolina de Jesus Award, which was given to someone who's changed his or her life through literature. Binho explains how literature, and more importantly, the FLUP Festival, have helped improve his life.
A festa literária da Zona Oeste foi inspirada...
He tells me that he's been writing since he was 18 years old, but that his first book was only published a year ago, when he was 33 years old. He says that FLUP gave him the opportunity to attract attention from publishers, an opportunity that he didn't have before the festival started.
Da palavra na periferia. Então, a Zona Oeste do Rio de Janeiro...
In fact, Binho was so inspired by Floop that 2 years ago he started a literary festival of his own called Flizu, a literary festival set up just for the West Zone of Rio de Janeiro, helping give a literary platform for the city's most populated area.
And I wrote a book called The Spider King's Daughter. And actually, before I go there, remember the name of this panel is
And ideas from abroad are helping influence local writers here too. There are 30 foreign writers at the festival this year, with one of the standout names being Chibundu Unuzo, the 23-year-old Nigerian author of The Spider King's Daughter.
If we need to do more, will there be, is there any more?
Yeah, I have 100 bottles.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
English poet Hannah Walker is also amongst the foreign authors here. She tells about her poetry project she's introducing here at Floop.
The one we're setting up for right now is called Poetry to Go. Came from an idea from a guy called Tim Clare, who made something called the Poetry Takeaway. You basically write poems to order, like a fast food truck. People come up and say, hi, I want a poem for my grandma, my cat, my whatever, and you write a poem to their specifications, and then you give it to them for free. I make work that's quite interactive, like to try and break down some of the boundaries between poetry and people, when people think poetry is not for them.
It doesn't take long before Hannah starts getting orders for her poetry. 48-year-old Rosa de Souza wants Hannah to write a poem for her 12-year-old daughter.
Ontem à noite eu briguei muito com ela, porque ela está na semana de provas e ela não estudou quase nada.
She had an argument with her daughter yesterday because she's having tests at school, exams, and she didn't study.
Ela foi dormir chorando e eu fiquei muito mal a noite toda também.
She went to bed crying and the mother felt really bad.
Okay. And what would you like to tell her?
She wants to say sorry. Okay. And that she thinks she exaggerated.
Thank you. I can do this. 10 minutes approximately, and I'll come and meet you over by the table with your poem.
And with that limited information, Hannah scribbles away busily on a piece of paper. And 10 minutes later, here's the result.
So it's called Until You Reach It.
Até atingir. É o nome do poema, tá?
So the first line is, there is a future behind the mountain. One you cannot see yet.
Um futuro que você ainda não enxerga.
But I can.
Mas eu enxergo.
It opens for you like a box of sky.
Abre como uma caixa
de a sea of marigolds.
Um mar de marigolds.
I plant my feet by your bedroom door.
Eu, coloco meus pés lá.
Grow you in dreams, cell by cell.
Cultivo você nos meus sonhos.
You draw on your bedroom wall.
Você desenha.
And I ask you to color it in.
Eu
I see you growing books out of your fingers.
Eu vejo crescendo.
Forgive me.
Me perdoe.
But I will wait here.
Mas eu vou esperar aqui.
Plant my feet by your bedroom door.
Planto meus pés ao lado.
Hold your hand until we reach it.
Segure sua mão até chegarmos lá.
Muito obrigada. Fiquei emocionada.
With about 10,000 visitors expected to pass through Floop during the week-long festival, not only is it giving under-discovered writers the chance to showcase their talents, but by being held in Mangueira Favela, it also invites cariocas to experience the scenery of a different part of their city that they might not usually go to. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thanks, Sheena. After the break, we'll be at the Singapore Art Book Fair. Stay tuned.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our 4 daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, where we're now venturing to Asia. Singapore's artistic hotspot at the Gillman Barracks hosted the nation's second ever art book fair, which specialises in contemporary art books and zines of all scales. Heavyweight publishers, the likes of Gestalten and Feiden, showcased their latest tomes alongside local independent titles, and there were music performances and art exhibitions to entertain vendors and visitors alike. Monocle's Jason Lee spoke with festival director Kenny Leck, who's also the owner of a publishing company and an independent bookshop, and here they are.
The Singapore Art Book Fair is unlike any other art book fairs that is held in other places in the world, in other cities. Our art book fair, besides showcasing art book publishers, we actually like the idea of showcasing people who are running independent zines. There are a few gallery owners who run their own art publications. We also have partners who are doing bookbinding. They are showcasing what they have been doing in terms of their craftsmanship. I have another partner. They are actually a tertiary institution in Singapore. But what they have done is they are using common household food items like tomato sauce. They'll put it inside a petri dish and they'll allow it to decompose basically, and it becomes a work of art in a sense, and everything is documented, and we hope to have it done in a publication hopefully a few months down the road. So for us, Art Book Fair, it's not just art books per se, but literally we are including as many creative partners in this industry, and not just Singapore, but hopefully we have a couple of partners who are from overseas. We have Love Print. It's a bunch of collective people. They are all from UAE, so they'll be coming in tomorrow night when they fly in.
And it's only the second year. It's a lot of things for a second year.
When it comes to books, it has always been a bit neglected. Publications has always been on the sidelines. If you look at the state of the bookstores in Singapore, we are suffering from a lack of bookstores. And I think that translates into the people who are keen to actually take up this challenge of doing an art book fair. And I think for us, it was a decision that we made without much thinking, to be honest. Justin, a year before, he had been to the Tokyo Art Book Fair. He came back, you know, he loved what was going over there. Then he came back and said, well, he saw me and he said, hey, you know, you guys do books, right? You guys do publishing, right? Why don't we run an art book fair? And I said, yeah, okay, why not? You know, and the whole thing just started from there.
So you were talking about the business side of things. So can you tell me about the business significance, the commercial significance of a book fair like this?
What we are doing here is that we are not targeting any specific demographic. I'm running the philosophy similar to what we've been running Books Actually itself, where I really don't have a specific demographic. You know, say for example, when I retail the Monocle magazine in the store, I'm not trying to sell it to a person who already knows Monocle, who is already a well-traveled person, you know, in a demographic that in the 20s, late 20s, 30s, you know. When I sell Monocle, I wish to sell it to a 14, 15-year-old kid who is in a bookstore, you know. When this child at 14, 15 years old, when he or she picks up a Monocle magazine, the world opens up a little bit more. And I think it's the same thing in the book fair, you know. We do not want to say that, oh, this is strictly an art book fair or this is strictly for the people who are interested in art. You know, we want everybody to come in and have a good time. One best example is, I have this artist called Spit Cryptic. He does fantastic wall murals, you know, and he'll always do it on a white wall with his black ink. And this time he came with this idea, why not transform his mural into a colouring book? So what we did was, again, he did his usual art mural and we got on crayons. So anybody from the public, you know, no matter what age you are, you have a giant colouring book now. I think that's that philosophy, to have everybody and anybody come in and have a good time, you know, and that's it.
And it also applies to the vendors. You have like big publishers like Gestalten and then more Feiden and then more independent companies like Magpie and then really, really independent and local like Afterglobe. So how did you pick all these companies, and are big companies happy to sit next to someone who's relatively unknown?
Okay, I think we are luckier in a sense that they are all friends, partners that we actually have befriended and know through the bookstore itself. Because of the bookstore, we are either stocking up or we are their stockers for their books or for their zines, you know. And I think that gives us instant access point to put it together. And I think for us, we have a very straightforward approach, you know. If, say, we approach a super big publisher and we say, you know, do you guys want to join the art book fair, you know, and if their next question comes to me, so who are the other vendors? And if I say so-and-so, you know, smaller vendors, and if they're not interested, to be honest, I will try to convince them a second round, but when it comes to the time, I'll say, you know, so be it, you know, because the way this whole thing runs is to be as inclusive as possible. You know, I do not just want 50,000 people in Singapore to want and learn and love to appreciate art. I wish 500,000, 5 million even, you know, to say that art is essential to their lives, you know, whether in a very big way, in a very small way. You do not need to be an art collector or have studied art to love art. You know, it's all around us in a sense, so that's where we are going ahead.
But surely there's some form of quality control, so how do you go about doing
there
that?
There is definitely quality control. We try our best, to be honest. We really try our best. How do we go about? I really tried and tested already. Holycrap.sg with the exhibition, the Rubbish Femzine. We had hosted them for their book launch for issue number 2, Rubbish Femzine. And of course, when we knew that they have the intention to do the number 3, you know, but the timeline was most probably they were thinking of doing next year. And then we told them, hey, we're doing art book fair, I have a venue for you. You guys want to, you know, push the timeline out and do it together, you know. So that's how we try to approach as many of the partners as possible. We have already know what we have in mind.
And what is your hope and dream for the art book fair?
That it continues being run. It doesn't need to be run by us in a sense. We are not going to be around forever. We might move on to more exciting things, or we might try to make it even more exciting every year. But I think we are bound to grow old. I think we shouldn't be just the ones running it. You know, if anybody is up for a challenge, has a new idea, can grow and run it. And I'm not going to use the word, you know, run it bigger, better, you know, nothing. It doesn't have to be bigger every year. You know, if I have 50 vendors this year, it doesn't mean that I have to have 60 or 70 vendors next year. It always has to be quality control, right? That's my wish for the book fair, that even if at some point in time we decide that, well, we will pass the baton on to someone has a better idea, has a better drive, then it should go on. It will always go on. It's meant to be a fair to welcome everybody. Whether you're in Singapore, you're traveling through Singapore, you're working in Singapore, everybody is welcome.
That was Kenny Leck, director of the Singapore Art Book Fair, speaking to Monocle's Jason Lee. And now that report's moved us seamlessly from literature to art, sort of. Here's what you can expect in the second half of the show. We'll discover a new exhibition in London which uses the senses to explore one artist's memories of growing up in Lagos. And we head to contemporary Istanbul to see how the city is competing with the rest of the world for a place on the global art map. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. But first, another song from this week's Midori House session. Songhai Blues are in the studio today playing tracks from their upcoming record, Music in Exile. It's one to put on your 2015 wish list. And from it, this is Ir Janda.
Ir Janda. Oh, ba, fa, ba, benda, me, mir, fa, ba, ir, pita, la, bera, deru, mir, fa, ba, ir, kanda. Oh, ba, fa, ba, benda, me, mir, fa, ba, ir, pita, la, bera, deru, mir, fa, ba, ir, kanda, ga, ba, fa, ba, ir, mir, fa, ba, ir, ture, dumbandi. Virfaba, iri soyo kogu. Virfaba, adapa wizuru. Virfaba, iri kanda gaba faba. Virfaba, yeah. Iri kanda, uba faba. Bainda mai mirfaba. Virfaita la berajero. Mirfaba. Irkanda, Irkanda,
faba irkanda ga ba faba
faba
irkanda ga ba tasu
faba
irkanda ga ba taba
faba
irkanda ga ba kara
faba
irkanda ga ba hari
faba
irkanda ga ba taba
faba
irkanda ga ba kara
faba
kara sikacha
faba
kara sikacha
faba
irkanda goba faba bainda mai mir faba irpaitala berajero mir faba
That was Songhai Blues with Ejian Da. And to find out more about upcoming gigs and projects, head to africaexpress.co.uk. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I'm Robert Bound. Istanbul is in the midst of a flurry of cultural activity this autumn. From the Istanbul Design Biennial to Arts International to Istanbul Art Week, the city straddling Europe and Asia is living up to its recently bestowed title as a space of cultural output from emerging markets across the globe. From China to the Middle East, contemporary artists are flocking to Istanbul. Given the rush of attention, One Art Festival, which opened last week, is attempting to take the temperature of the Istanbul art scene at the present moment. No small task. So we sent our Istanbul Bureau Chief Joseph Dana to contemporary Istanbul to find out more.
The first thing you notice about contemporary Istanbul is the size of the exhibition space. Unlike other art events in the city, it's held in a prime and very large space overlooking the Bosphorus on Istanbul's European shores. The second thing you notice is the wide variety of corporate sponsors showcasing their logos next to impressive works of contemporary art. The relationship between culture and corporate money is a near constant debate in the Turkish art world and at contemporary Istanbul.
The young intelligentsia, and to a large extent the old intelligentsia, they kind of went underground. They kind of submerged. They kind of withdrew from certain levels of discourse. They didn't want to share what they were thinking so intimately.
That is Paul McMillan, a member of the advisory board of contemporary Istanbul.
They didn't assume a friendship. They didn't assume a common platform. They said, no, the only people that understand where we're coming from will understand what we're saying. We don't want to talk to those people that don't understand or are hostile to what we're saying. Yes? So that has created a brand new dynamic and a very important dynamic. And it's not just here, actually. In Turkey, it is very, very clear. It's very clear. But it's also happened in America. It's also, if you ask me, happening in China. And it also seems to be happening in India as well, where you actually have an alternative culture as the main culture.
Contemporary Istanbul began in 2006 with just under 50 galleries and roughly $11 million in sales. Last year, the exhibition grew to host 58 foreign and 38 local galleries, which raised over $90 million in sales.
Contemporary Istanbul Uluslararası Çağdaş Sanat Fuarı.
Financial growth has led to exciting new developments and brand recognition in Turkey. CI Editions is a new initiative aimed at promoting a variety of artistic output in mostly printed form. The exhibition published a handsome and well-researched magazine, along with a wide spectrum of artist material in various mediums, aimed at new collectors and art lovers. Andrew Foxel is a creative director who designed Contemporary Istanbul's mobile application. He explains how the branding of the exhibition is paying dividends in Turkey.
The whole magazine, the whole premise, and also with CI Editions, is about getting the next generation of collectors interested and engaged. And in Turkey, it's fantastic to offer that in Turkey and to open that up. And you know, lots of political things happening recently in Turkey and will do for a while. It's such a divided country in lots of ways. So, you know, what can you do inside it? And one big thing is to allow people to connect with the things that contemporary art has to offer, you know, for furtherment of betterment of culture and society. So that's great. So I think in terms of it being good, yes, it's a huge force in the contemporary art scene and in Turkey, and it's almost a household name, which is very interesting. There's not many households that know the Fries name in London or in the UK. So in that respect, I think it's quite yeah, we're interested, we're excited, we're almost evangelical about it.
In order to harness the power of emerging art trends, Contemporary Istanbul continued its new media section called Plug-in this year. Showcasing the best in digital art and design, Plug-in is typified by a diverse mix of sound and light installations, video art, and indoor mapping projects. The reason for this section is simple: keep younger artists engaged. Paul McMillan, again.
I mean, the energy is being carried forward by young people. It's very good for it. I mean, we never had such good art. Our artists are very savvy. They're very up to speed. They're also very keen to get their voice out. They want to be heard abroad. It's not just for monetary and for fame reasons. They really want to share some of their ideas because they would like to be part of an ascending intellectual perspective, let's say, a value perspective.
With any art event in Istanbul, discussion inevitably drifts to the question of whether the city has embraced its position as one of the capitals of the emerging art world. For Paul McMillan, the answer is clear. Istanbul has always been a city that attracts the best and brightest in the art world. Just look at the map.
It's very important what is said here. Look at the map. Look to the north of Turkey. Look to the east of Turkey. Look to the west of Turkey. And the south, obviously, you know, that. If you look at that, we're in a very interesting neighborhood. Whatever is thought of and said here and how well it is formed actually is very important. It's an indicator territory, let's say, for intellectual development. And a lot of people are very closely following that because a lot of people are very concerned about what happens to countries when there is a declared religious dimension. People are very worried and concerned and thinking and sensitive and spend a lot of time doing all of the evaluation to figure what the hell's going on sort of feeling. But that's also true in Turkey, you see. That's also true here. So what you have is a very dynamic situation. But finally, the Times created, I think, an articulation, a really good voice that started to happen, I think.
Given the flood of art events this fall, it is challenging to gauge the health of the Istanbul art world. There is real energy in the Turkish art community, and that energy is translating to the opening of new galleries and continued financial growth. Turkey has an educated and politically active younger generation who are increasingly turning to art as the vehicle for self-expression and social commentary. The risk now is finding the proper balance between financial concerns and the purity of art. Given that that problem exists in the great art cities of the world, it can be said that Istanbul has finally arrived. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favorite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
This is Culture and I am Robert Bound. Lagos, over 20 million inhabitants, the most populous city in Nigeria, the second fastest city in Africa. Those are the facts. But how are they translated in one's memories? Maybe a particular smell, a colour, certain sounds. This is what artist Mary Evans, who was born in the city but moved to the UK in her childhood, tries to recollect through her work. Together with Emeka Ogbo, who currently resides in Lagos, they've attempted to put together the different pieces of their experiences in the megacity through images and sound. Monocle's Gaia Lutz headed down to the Tiwani Contemporary Gallery to find out more about the duo's work in their new show, Mirrors and Echoes.
Emeka and I met at Art Dubai in March 2013. We were both exhibiting there. while we were there, we were asked to take part in a kind of radio conversation. It ended up being quite a natural conversation. We were talking about Nigeria, about Lagos. A lot of it was based on my memories of it because I hadn't been there for a long time. And also his position of working there as an artist and using the city as kind of as his canvas and his medium.
The theme of the exhibition is obviously, as you're saying, deeply rooted and set in Lagos. Can you tell me a bit about both your and Emeka's relation to the city?
Well, my relationship to the city is quite a historical one. I was born there, but I haven't actually been there for quite a long time, for nearly 25 years. So in a way, my relationship to the city is very nostalgic, and it's very much about memory. And it's also not just about memory and nostalgia, but memory and nostalgia as a child. So that can be quite distorted. As an adult, the last time I was in Lagos was in 1991. But Emeka's relationship with the city is very much as an artist, as a person who lives there and who uses the city as his medium. And he records it, he's out and about in it, talking to people, recording the city, the sounds, and that's kind of become very much part of our project together.
How does this memory and history feature in your work?
For me, in this piece of work, it features kind of in key images. We started to talk, and I started to say what I remembered, and I remembered things like lots and lots and lots of people. I remembered lots and lots of noise, which was quite appropriate for him. I remembered key things like little boys playing with hoops. I remembered people in the market, hawkers. I talked to him about visions of hawkers. My memories are all very visual, and interestingly enough, Emeka kind of turned my visual memories into sound, into audio, in a way.
Is this what we're seeing now, these cutouts?
Yeah, I think this is what we're looking at. I mean, in a way, what I like about this piece of work is that both of us as artists have kind of kept the integrity of our own individual practice. So I'm still working with my paper cutouts and my kind of repetitions of figures and black bodies in space. Emeka's working with his soundscapes as well, his kind of speakers. The 3D elements in this work are all Emeka's work, the trays, the speakers, etc. I remember sounds and smells and sights. All those three kind of senses really were really quite assaulted, I think, when you're in a city like Lagos. So sound is really important. But it's not so much that we chose sound and paper cutouts. That's just how we both work, and it just seemed to go together. I'll turn it for you.
Wow. I love kaleidoscopes. Wow. And what was the inspiration behind this? Is this?
Well, I've been making kaleidoscopes since about 2000. This has been part of my work. One of the ways that I worked in the past is to remember. A lot of my work is to do with memories and remembering things. So I remembered that I used to love kaleidoscopes as a child. So I was making them and exhibiting them. One of the aspects of my practice that isn't so obvious with this piece of work here is that in the past my work has often been quite decorative. And I found that the kaleidoscope as a device immediately just makes it into something decorative, into something pretty to look at. So when Emeka and I were talking, he sent me JPEGs of these, and it's as though I'd forgotten that I'd made kaleidoscopes, and I remembered. I thought, oh, why? I used to make kaleidoscopes, and I felt that, yeah, it would be appropriate for this show for me to make a couple, and also to use his imagery inside my work. So it really is really kind of synergized and comes together in that way. I think my memories of Lagos are extremely subjective and extremely romantic and rose-tinted. And in a way, what's interesting about the kaleidoscope is that it compounds that. You know, you're looking at something that's it's even further kind of beautified.
That was artist Mary Evans speaking to Gaia Lutz. The exhibition Mirrors and Echoes is at the Tiwani Contemporary Gallery and runs until the 20th of December. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher. Thanks to her for almost squeezing down those gargantuan cues. Time for one final song this week from Mali's Songhoi Blues. This is Sekou Umaru. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Anna Sara Yaman, Ikata Guna, Wayvogan, Sekou Laroa Yaman, Ikata Guna, Wayvogan, Sekou Surugu Ayaman, Ikata Guna, Wayvogan, Sekou Sekou Maru, Tijani Futan, Kerman, Dadima, Sekou Maru, Tijani Futan, Kerman, Dadima, Sekou. Nichingar maka
Sekou
Ni salam madina
Sekou
Ni bisanda dida
Sekou
Ni bisanda arafa
Sekou
Ni gara fita
Sekou
Ni bisanda masina
Sekou
Sekou
Jijani futanker mamdani ma
Sekou maru
Jijani futanker mamdani ma
Sekou
Sekou
ni tubindi chefer
Sekou
ni sarga yatima
Sekou
Sekou maru
tijani futanker mamdani ma
Sekou maru
tijani futanker mamdani ma
Sekou.